I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. This was the most expensive election ever. It looks like $6 billion was raised, and a large portion of it was spent on mostly negative TV ads, especially in battleground states. The Citizens United decision freed up super PACs and advocacy groups to spend unlimited amounts of money this campaign season. And now there's some grumbling from some big donors about whether they made a wise investment. So today on Radio Times, how much did money matter in 2012? Does wall-to-wall political advertising sway voters? And how do citizens engage with the political process? We have two guests who have joined us. Here with us here in our Philadelphia studio is Robin Kolodny. She's an associate professor of political science at Temple University. She studies campaign spending and political advertising, and it's been many years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
And joining us by telephone is Diana Mutz. She's the Samuel A. Stouffer Professor of Political Science and Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, also director of the Institute for the Study of Citizens and Politics in the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania, and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Diana Mutz, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
Let me begin with you, if I could, Robin. And I'm still recovering from the fact that $6 billion was spent during this election season. When you look at that money, is it spread pretty much sort of across the board, or where was the big money spent?
Well, what we see in terms of the presidential race is that both candidates, interestingly enough, seem to have about the same amount of money available to their side. Now, that came in different constituencies. So the president, for example, was able to raise a lot more money through his personal presidential campaign organization, whereas Mitt Romney seemed to be, for a while, having a lot less available. However, the outside spending was in favor of Mitt Romney and not so much in favor of President Obama. But at the end of the day, when you add up what the national party committees, the candidate campaigns themselves, and the outside groups spent altogether, it's basically a wash.
Wow. So it's a billion we're talking about.
Pretty much, yes.
From your perspective, Diana Mutz, how much do you think money mattered this election season?
Well, at the presidential level, very little. We have lots of evidence that, you know, political advertising can make a huge difference at down ballot races, things like congressional races and so forth, where really all that it takes is name recognition to increase your vote share. But the presidential level, there is so much advertising on both sides going on, as well as so much free media from the news and other sources, that it takes a lot more than that to persuade people. And there's really very little evidence that the advertising is effective at the presidential level.
Because all these ads are sort of canceling each other out?
Well, that's part of it, but it's also the case that people have alternative sources of information. And, you know, Americans are not stupid. They know advertisements are meant to persuade them. And so I think we have lots of skepticism, and rightfully so, about the kind of information that they're exposed to in the political ads. So the idea that they can be determinative is highly unlikely, and if they do have an influence, it's a very, very short-term kind of influence before that little piece of information in the 30-second ad is overwhelmed by something else they heard on the news or on the radio and so forth.
Robin, going back to you, and we were talking about this before the show began, because again, my jaw dropped. In Nevada, or certainly parts of Nevada, there were something like 10,000 ads a week. And I'm trying to imagine how that was distributed. How is that possible?
I don't know exactly how they were distributed, but of course you've got the major networks, the independent stations, and you've got the cable box. And that's where I think sometimes people lose sight of that. Cable advertising is significantly cheaper than broadcast advertising. And even in the Philadelphia region, candidates tend to buy significantly more ads, individual ad on cable, than they do on broadcast. And so that's where it's very possible to spend that way. Now, the problem is, of course, you don't know who you're getting, who you're actually watching. In fact, some of the concern with cable is that these are actually the most informed and most likely to vote viewers. So they could be, in many ways, the least persuadable, because they've made up their minds some time ago, perhaps even before the conventions were held before the nominee for the Republicans was determined, they may have decided, in which case they're truly unpersuadable.
There are a lot of people, or there are a lot of stations, I guess, that made a lot of money during this campaign season. We're talking about billions of dollars.
Absolutely, there were. And that is actually one of the interesting things about this, is that what do those stations do with those profits? Interestingly enough, they go ahead and keep their news operations going. They do employ people as a result of the profits that they make. And so, you know, sometimes there's an interesting question. Where would that money have gone otherwise? What would wealthy interests have spent the money on? I doubt that it would be on, you know, newsrooms, for example.
Well, that's interesting. Diana, do you want to add to that?
No, I would just add that this is, I think, part of the problem is that no one in the media business has any incentive whatsoever to want to call attention to the questionable effectiveness of all of this, because there's a huge amount of money made during presidential elections and elections in general on this advertising. And so the cycle keeps going like this because of that, even though I think candidates and political consultants all know that they really don't know what they're getting for their money.
So campaign strategists, I would assume with all this money spent, and of course there are winners and there are losers, that the campaign strategists working for the losers have some explaining to do, Diana Mutz. If people are spending millions of dollars to get somebody elected.
Well, but explaining after the fact, you can always point to something, we shouldn't have done this, or we should have done that, or it was, you know, a function of the hurricane, or, you know, people are very good at coming up with stories to tell after the fact. Seldom, however, will they say, we shouldn't have spent any money on political advertising. That tends not to be part of the explanation. I mean, they might claim, this person had a more negative ad campaign, but this is really after-the-fact explanation. This is not something that they have evidence on. So it's very much the case that when candidates lose, we tend to, you know, blame various factors, but we don't tend to have any real evidence that that's the case. Everybody, after the fact, is good at explaining why something happened, but it's not something that we really should have any confidence in as an explanation.
There was an interesting article in the New York Times today, something like $300 million donated to or given to Karl Rove's outside groups or his super PACs. Linda McMahon has spent about $100 million trying to be a senator from Connecticut, lost both times. Mm-hmm. The Koch brothers raised about $400 million. Sheldon Adelson, about $60 million. Sheldon Adelson is 0 for 6, as I understand. Is it, Robin, that these are just very wealthy people, and this is kind of chump change for them?
Well, that I couldn't say, because we don't know their whole worth, but this is something that the courts and the campaign finance regulation scheme has protected. That is your individual right to spend your money as you wish. And if you want to spend it on political advertising and you want to give it to the candidates that you care about the most, there is nothing that is going to prohibit you, obviously, in this the current regulatory environment from doing that. And that's part of the thing here. I don't know what he would have spent the money on otherwise, but he made a choice to do this. And I doubt that his life, frankly, is going to be a lot different whether his candidate won or lost. But nevertheless, there's a certain social satisfaction, and there's also the idea that you're a player, that you're included in a lot of close conversations, which is probably why they do this kind of thing.
Because it gets them closer to a candidate or to a campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Again, Diana, did you want to add to that?
Well, I was just saying, I think it's interesting that this is getting so much attention this election year, because I think many people find it very reassuring to see that you can spend huge amounts of money and not buy the election. And as much attention as money in politics gets, usually it's all about how money determines everything. There's a classic survey question that always gets asked about, does the person with the most money usually win? And, you know, there's a lot of cynicism out there. And in some ways, I think it's fortunate that we have high-profile examples that we can point to say to people, you know what, it really isn't quite that simple. And that raising the most money just buys you the office and so forth.
Just rolling back the clock, Diana, and I know from some of the work that you've done, you have looked at how people make up their mind about particular candidates. What are some of the factors that go into that decision-making?
Well, right now, as Robin said, because the population is fairly heavily partisan, what we see in our data is that, you know, something like 85% of the public made up their mind long before summer began. So it really had nothing to do with the campaign per se. Now, that being said, the much smaller percentage of people who are undecided or people who are potentially persuadable is very important. But I think the problem with our whole political communication system is that when we look at the amount of money that's spent for persuading such a small number of people, we have to say this is not a very efficient process for having candidates contact voters and attempt to persuade them. And I think it's perfectly fine that they try to do that. That's what they're supposed to do. That's how our whole system is predicated. But there's got to be a less expensive way to accomplish that when it comes to the sheer number of people that we're talking about, which is a relatively small percentage of the population.
Now, I realize we're talking about millions of people here, Diana, but when you say that folks probably made up their mind before the summer, was that because of their party affiliation? Perhaps they had seen something on television or read something, or they just naturally gravitate to one candidate or another?
It's based on partisan identification, and we see that very strongly. Sometimes, for example, in 2008, even when we didn't yet know who the Democratic nominee was, these people knew they were voting for the Democrat, and it really didn't matter. So party just plays a huge role in structuring the outcome. And even among those who didn't necessarily say they were voting for their party's candidate beginning in June, what we see happening as the election draws near is that whatever partisan inclinations they have, those tend to weigh more heavily as the election comes near. So even people who say they're undecided will tend to fall to the side of their, you know, party identification and so forth. That doesn't mean there aren't undecided voters.
Right.
There are, but they're a really, really small percent by the time you get to the end of an election when all the advertising and so forth is taking place.
It's interesting, Robin, only because we hear from the, you know, the pundits, whoever they are, that there is less party affiliation, that people are you know, more looking around and playing the field. But what I hear sounds like from both of you is that party really still matters.
Oh, absolutely. And also, we know that people who claim they're independent seem to vote in some ways more consistently with the party toward which they lean than even committed partisans. So
really?
It's a way of saying I don't approve of the party system, even though I tend one way or another. And also, sometimes I think we give a false sense that portrays you as a more engaged citizen if you're independent enough to be able to look at the issues dispassionately and not let party be your guide. But generally speaking, the parties, especially now, have done a pretty good job of sorting people out by issue positions in terms of their candidates and in terms of the constituencies.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Robin Kolodny. She's an associate professor of political science at Temple University. She studies campaign spending and political advertising. There was a lot of spending and a lot of advertising this political season. Also with us is Diana Mutz, and she's a professor of political science and communication at the University of Pennsylvania. Lines open. Any questions or comments, reactions, do give us a call. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We'll be right back.
JerseyArts.com supports WHYY, featuring Heaven, Hell, and the History of Punch on the latest edition of the JerseyArts.com Culture Vultures blog. Blogger Shen Schellenberger reviews the exhibition, featuring works by sculptor Robert Taplin under three themes: the planets, Dante's Inferno, and the classic Italian character Pulcinella. Currently on view at Grounds for Sculpture in Hamilton. Heaven, Hell, and the History of Punch on the latest edition of the Culture Vultures blog. Online at JerseyArts.com.
As the nation wraps up a tough campaign season, we'll focus on the political issues facing Native Americans.
All tribal leaders are aware that there are major issues around poverty, substance abuse, and health.
We get a closer look at the politics and economics of Indian Country. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Penn's Department of Dermatology supports WHYY. Do you have moderate to severe psoriasis?
Penn is conducting a psoriasis clinical research study to determine if FDA-approved psoriasis treatments such as Humira, compared to phototherapy or placebo, improve cutting-edge markers of cardiovascular disease. To participate, you must be 18 or older and have psoriasis that covers 10% of your body. Info at 215-662-SKIN. 215-662-SKIN.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about money and politics, also talking about citizens' engagement with the political process, and again talking with Diana Mutz and Robin Kolodny. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Diana, I do want to talk about the media and the role that the media plays, but let me turn to you, Robin, because you showed me a very interesting graph before the show began on your computer there about sort of where the money went when it came to Romney and Obama, both of whom rejected federal public financing.
Yes, they did. And they both figured that they could raise more money on their own than they could get from the public money. And the restriction on the public money is that you can't spend any more than what they gave. And they're, of course, both right about that. They did raise significantly, multiples of that. But the president was able to raise as of the October 21st filings, about $550 million for Obama for America, and Mitt Romney's campaign was able to spend to raise about $340 million. And before you feel badly for him, you need to realize that one of the things that Romney did that was very clever this election cycle was to have those high-dollar fundraisers, $50,000, $75,000, where clearly that's more money than he could raise for his own organization. That would be about $10,000 for him, $5,000. $2,500 per election, so $5,000. So what he would do is also say to the donor that this portion of your money, about $30,000 of it, will go to the Republican National Committee, and this portion will go to Romney for America, and here's some other joint committees, so that you see that the Republican National Committee that can spend independently of Romney for as much as they would like, as much as they can bring in $30,000 donations or less, they raised a good bit more, probably about 30% more than the Democratic National Committee did. And the outside group spending was greater for Romney by about double than it was for the president. However, if you add the money all together as of those late October numbers, then you'd see that they had almost about $1 billion each at their disposal. So it was really quite shocking to me to see how evenly that it was spread out. But it was just how they, that money was raised was somewhat different.
But does that give us an indication about how the Obama campaign was able to win re-election? Well, when you look at that, the way the money came in and how it was spent?
I would say yes for a couple of reasons. One is that Obama is raising money in smaller increments than Romney is. Now, that's not the same as saying that everybody was a $25 donor, but he was more likely to have the $200 donor, let's say, than Romney was, who would have the larger one. Every time somebody is going to even spend $25 on your campaign, that's a vote. That's also somebody who's committed to vote for you. And they're likely to tell people that they work with, their neighbors, that, hey, I just donated to Obama, or what do you guys, what do you think of this election? That kind of thing. So that's the first. The other is that we've been talking about buying political advertising, but what we haven't talked about is one reason Obama had all this money is that he started raising that money a bit earlier, and as we heard about in Ohio in particular, spent it more on the ground, on opening offices, on paying rents and paying people that way so that they could go door to door and get a list of people who were committed to the campaign and register new voters. Romney did that, but much later in the game than Obama was doing it.
What's so interesting, Diane, is that you see sort of the old-fashioned door-to-door campaigning married to some of this data-driven politics.
You do, and yet we still don't know very much about, you know, how effective it is. And I think there's been a lot more research on using it to get out the vote than there has been on persuading anyone to change their mind. So, and I haven't seen the final figures. I don't think they're out yet for this year. But as I understand it, voter turnout was not particularly strong this election year.
Not as strong as 2008.
Right.
But how much about word of mouth? And Robin talked about, you know, if you give some money to a campaign, there's a good chance you might tell your neighbor, your coworker. How does that work, Diana?
Well, I can't speak specifically to the small donor situation, but many people don't tell friends and neighbors unless they're already certain that person is on the same side. They worry about social harmony and their relationships with their neighbors and so forth, and so they're very cautious about revealing that kind of information, except in situations where they know everybody's on the same page. And the problem with that, and the problem with our political discussion networks in general, is that we tend to like to talk politics with people who agree with us, not with people who are going to be on the other side. And yet, our potential to influence other people is obviously much greater when we disagree, because that's when we might be able to persuade them. But it's very funny. I think Americans have this kind of awkward attitude toward political persuasion. On one hand, you know, we're told that this isn't the polite thing to do. You don't talk about religion or politics in mixed company. On the other hand, it's supposed to be part of our political process that we persuade one another and involve ourselves in discussions that do cross lines of difference. So, but in my own research, I found people are very wary of getting involved in conversations like that.
Is it also a kind of ambivalence or even negative perception of our political system?
You know, that's a good question. I would say, in general, people aren't thinking so much about the political system as they are about, you know, their neighbors, their mm-hmm. friends, getting along with the folks at work and so forth. They're understandably far more anchored in the ease with which they conduct their day-to-day lives than they are making some sort of broader statement about the political system.
And is it also true that, people seek out the media that reinforces the beliefs that they have anyway?
They do, but I would say from most of the coverage of this kind of issue, which academics call selective exposure, is really kind of overplaying it. The percentage of Americans who rely strictly on partisan news sources is very, very tiny. So most people still get their news from mainstream kinds of sources, whether it's television, internet, print sources, and so forth. So they're really a teeny tiny percentage of people. I think it's, you know, way under 10% who are actually just exposing themselves to some sort of partisan reinforcing message. So most of these people either use that along with mainstream sources, or they use a whole variety of sources on various sides.
Robin, you want to add to that?
Well, from my understanding, that this is changing as a generational cohort changes, that our students are much more likely to get their news from the Daily Show and the Colbert Report, let's say, than their grandparents would be. So I think that, you know, it would be interesting to see how that plays out in future election cycles.
And that's Robin Kolodny. She's an associate professor of political science at Temple University, studies campaign spending, political advertising. Diana Mutz is a professor of political science and communication at the University of Pennsylvania. And she has looked at political persuasion and communication. And we are making sense of the 2012 election. And, of course, lots of money spent, something like $6 billion spent for both the national and local races. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let's see what John from Royersford has to say. And John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I've been listening to this conversation, and I've seen my share of advertisements on TV. And, you know, it just suddenly hit me maybe yesterday that none of the party strategizing or the marketing or the ads on TV matter if I don't feel like I like the candidate. Mm. And for me, it came down to a very sort of just a personal, there was just, I couldn't get behind Governor Romney, even though I am normally a conservative voter and somebody that normally has moderate to conservative leaning opinions. You know, the pundits have been saying for the last couple of days, maybe we didn't get your vote because we didn't appeal to, you know, X, Y, or Z, or maybe we didn't win because we didn't campaign enough in this or that area. For me, anyway, no, you didn't get my vote because it wasn't a good enough candidate. And maybe I'm naive, but am I missing something? I mean, why don't they put their money into candidate development instead?
Well, Brian, it's an interesting question.
I'll take my answer off the air.
I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Diana, let me start with you, but Rahman, I'd like to hear from you as well. This is this likability factor.
Right. It's such an intangible. I think, you know, one person could get very excited about someone that another couldn't. So I guess that's the hard part about defining this. Certainly there are candidates who have connected more with their own partisans than Governor Romney did. So, and that may just be a matter of personal style and, you know, things of that kind. But I think there's a tendency after the fact to attribute a lot of things to personality and so forth that, again, it's a convenient shorthand for whether we like them or not. And whether we like a given person is a combination of so many different things. I mean, think about many of the people who we've elected president, Richard Nixon and so forth. The guy did not have charisma. That was not how he got elected. So, you know, there are lots of examples we have where people who are not particularly likable, nonetheless, were elected. And so, certainly, whether someone finds someone likable, yes, that predicts whether or not they're willing to vote for them to a great extent. But what is it ultimately that makes them likable to us is a much more difficult question.
Go ahead, Robin.
I think John has hit on something that's very important that a few people have spoken about in this election cycle, which is that I think what we see now is the Republican Party in particular had an issue in their nominating process and in the kinds of people who presented themselves as alternatives, the response they got in the primaries, and then how a general election is won. People should think about the Etch-a-Sketch quote from early in the Romney cycle and think about what that actually means. And so what the challenge was for the Republicans was to find a candidate who could both get the nomination and run a credible general election campaign amongst a more moderate electorate. And this was not an easy thing to do, given the candidates who were getting very positive responses early on, like our own Rick Santorum, who, by almost everybody's account, could not have done as well as Mitt Romney did in the general election campaign. So this is why a lot of discussion is going on now about what the Republican Party going to talk about internally. What's the Tea Party's contribution? Has it been one to actually to create more problems for them to find a candidate that can appeal to a broad sector of the electorate?
I was trying to reconcile some of the deep divisions within the party and whether they can come up with a winning formula.
Precisely. And that is an issue that you've seen then across the country. One thing we haven't mentioned is that the fact that the Democrats did as well as they did in the United States Senate is a surprise to everybody, including the Democrats. So there are a lot of interesting combinations of voting going on that's showing you something about where the public's trending.
Well, and just picking up on that, and Diane, I'd like to hear from you as well. We're seeing more women voted into the U.S. Senate, and as we know, there were a lot of quote-unquote women's issues that came up this election season. And Diana, do you think that was an important feature of the 2012 election, how women were talked about, how this horrible issue of rape was talked about, for instance?
Yeah, it's hard to say how much a role that played outside of those particular races. I think it definitely did in the races that you're talking about, where that those two candidates were involved in. More generally, what you know, our research usually shows is that the more women who run, the more they win.
Interesting.
And it's really not so much a function of women running for office and not being elected, but getting women to want to run for office. So it kind of gets back to Robin's observation about recruiting candidates and so forth. I think it's interesting in both of the last two presidential primaries, we had candidates selected who were known to be moderates, and then had trouble because they actually shifted toward more extreme perceptions in the public eye toward the general election. And you might expect things to go the opposite direction. That is, that during the primary season, they'd pick somebody who was more extreme who would then try to move to the middle for the general election. And certainly, you know, Romney tried to do that to some extent in the waning days of the campaign, but, you know, he began with the perception of being a moderate and really shifted in the other direction. And everything we know about this small group of people who are undecided, who are swing voters, is that they are not extremists. They are not ideologues.
Interesting. Let me get, looks like Doug from Phoenixville to join our conversation. And Doug, go ahead. You're on the air. That would be number five. Yeah, go ahead, Doug.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Doug.
I'm someone who votes according to party affiliation, kind of regardless of political advertising. I found a lot of the Obama advertising pretty offensive, but I voted for him in spite of that. I mean, I was pretty turned off by how small a lot of it was, how it lacked kind of vision and kind of a positive vision, kind of a sort of a plan for the future. But because of my values, because my values are in line with the Democratic Party, and I think this would go back to how first-time voters establish kind of, you know, how you can count on them to be to establish a kind of pattern. Because of their values, are in line with the party.
Well, Doug, that's an interesting...
Okay, but regardless of the advertising...
No, I hear you. Well, let me see what Robin Kolodny has to say.
Well, certainly that's how people develop partisan attachments in the first place, is that they are looking at a set of values that they personally have. And of course, in this election, just like almost every other American election, that is about how the economy is run and with regard to what approach to people who are the most vulnerable in that economy. And then beyond that, all the other issues are sort of layered on and can make things, I suppose, more complicated. But at bottom, that is pretty much how people align themselves with the various political parties. So I'm not surprised to hear from Doug that somebody whose values led him to cast his vote would think that the political advertising is shallow and not terribly interesting to him, because it really doesn't speak to his core values. I wouldn't disagree with that.
And broadly speaking, are negative ads more effective than the kind of positive ads that Doug was looking for?
Well, that's Diane, I'm sure we'll get right into this one. But,
no evidence that they are. Yeah,
really?
And a lot of it depends on what you mean by negative, too. Because some of these ads are really more comparative. That is, they're, you know, telling you this person has this stand and this person has this awful stand. And, you know, yes, they're negative because they put a spin on it that makes it sound far more ominous than a political disagreement normally would. But there's just very little evidence that they annoy people as well as perhaps drawing people's attention. I would say that, as with most advertising, one of its biggest effects is influencing what the rest of the media talk about all the time. So if a given issue is something like rape is mentioned, you know, let's say in an ad or in a comment somebody makes, that has an agenda-setting impact where everybody's talking about it, both in the press as well as among members of the public. But it's not as if it's changing their fundamental views on that issue.
And we're almost having a break here, and I guess some of that, Diana, becomes free advertising, and some of it both positive and negative, depending on what's being talked about on the media.
That's absolutely true. And, you know, there are lots of examples where extremely controversial ads have been made, and they've been aired only once, and the people who made them knew darn well they would only air them once,
right,
and they would be tremendously controversial, but then huge numbers of people saw them because they were replayed over and over again on the talk shows and on the news and so forth.
And that's Diana Mutz, again, a professor of political science and communication at the University of Pennsylvania, a director of the Institute for the Study of Citizens and Politics in the Annenberg Public Policy Center at Penn. Also with us is Robin Kolodny. She's an associate professor of political science at Temple University, and she studies campaign spending and political advertising. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
A century ago, Leopold Stokowski stepped on the podium. Now the Philadelphia Orchestra celebrates the Stokowski legacy. Emmanuel Cravine conducts Stokowski's arrangement of Bach's Toccata and Fugue, plus Franck's Symphony in D minor. Tickets at philorg.org or at 215-893-1999. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, the Stokowski legacy with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. What to do about Syria? We'll get a unique view of how the country's elites are weathering the civil war. And Adele is the latest in a string of superstars to help provide the score for James Bond. We'll get a reminder. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY and recognizes National Lung Cancer Awareness Month. Fox Chase offers a multitude of screening and treatment options for this deadliest of cancers that includes robotic-assisted surgery, video-assisted thoracoscopic techniques, stereotactic radiotherapy, and access to current clinical trials. Fox Chase physicians offer treatment options based on individualized plans of care, including multidisciplinary case review before treatment begins. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, now part of Temple Health.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Robin Kolodny and Diana Mutz about election 2012. How much did money matter? Does wall-to-wall political advertising sway voters? How about positive ads, negative ads? And how do citizens actually engage with our complicated political process? And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Robin, if you can share on the air what you just said to me about how negative ads can resonate, I guess, differently from positive ads.
Yes, negative ads are argued to be more effective because people remember them more. They may not like them, but they remember the contrast, and they are also laden with more facts than positive ads, which are meant to introduce a candidate and say, you know, give some kind of nebulous thing like they love their family,
right,
and they enjoy the park. Those are the kinds of things that are actually meant to give you much substance, but just more of a feeling.
And feelings matter, right?
Yes.
Let me get Ed from Philadelphia to join our conversation. Ed, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, Ed.
Thank you. My call.
Sure.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I wanted to mention, I personally believe that people who donate any sum under $500 to a campaign do it just for the sake of the campaign, whereas people that donate multiple thousands of dollars have an introduction for their lobbyist to see to it that certain legislation goes through. People that have large amounts of money into coal or other polluting things, they want to get as much favorable legislation as they can.
Well, Ed,
and what better way to introduce them than let them know who they are when their lobbyist shows up?
I appreciate the call to Radio Times. So, Diana, can I toss it first to you, and then Robin, I'd like to hear from you as well. Go ahead, Diana.
Well, there's no doubt that large donors, would like to have influence. I think the clearer thing that they are buying is access to the elected official, assuming that he or she wins. There are lots of lobbying groups that donate to both candidates, so you can, you know, understand that donation as having a very different purpose in mind than trying to change the election outcome. It's about access to the public official once they're in office. And, you know, I don't know about $500 being able to have much influence, but it's very difficult to assess influence when, for the most part, you're going to give your money to a candidate who already espouses the views that you want to promote. That's why you're donating money to them. And that's part of the reason why this whole question of money and influence is a very difficult one to examine.
Ed, thanks for the call. Go ahead, Robin.
Yes, to say to Ed, the issue which Diana was just raising is it's been impossible for political scientists to locate the smoking gun. That is, what's the amount of money or the day on which the amendment got passed because they hit the $100,000 mark or something like this. And that's not actually how we think it works at all. One thing we do find is that if there is a sector, let's say coal, for example, that donates a large amount of money overall to a candidate, the candidate will prioritize their time devoted to that issue. They wouldn't normally change their view or anything like this. So it's true, obviously, that large donors expect access, but sometimes we don't understand how that works. It's not always just to lobby directly on legislation. Sometimes it's to make sure you're on the right kinds of social lists to get invited to other kinds of events like that in the future. So maybe you're doing this because you'd like to get better involved with the Chamber of Commerce locally or with the National Federation of Independent Businesses, you know, organization, that kind of thing. So the access is a lot more multifaceted.
Ed, thanks for the call. Let's see what Brian from Cherry Hill has to say. Brian, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi. I just got a question real quick.
Sure.
We're talking about the Democrats and Republicans. What about, like, the Green Party and the Libertarians? Do we know how much money was spent on their parties?
Do you know, Robin?
I don't know now. We will know because they will have to file forms just like the other presidential candidates and with the Federal Election Commission, it will be insignificant compared to what the two major parties spent. Also, when with both the Libertarian and the Green parties, in the Libertarians in particular, usually have to spend so much of their money to get on the ballot, so a lot of it goes to legal fees. Here in Pennsylvania, there were significant challenges to the Libertarian Party's ballot position from the Republican Party, interestingly enough. And in other years, when the Greens look like they're doing well, the Democrats have invested a lot in trying to oppose their ballot position. So that is really the issue in terms of what's left over for both of those smaller parties to communicate is essentially not much.
Interesting. Brian, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Danny, I was reading some of your research, and you've looked into something you call media narcissism. What is that?
It's the tendency for the media to pay attention to the media.
Exactly.
As the story of the campaign. That is, spending time talking about whether or not one candidate or another is getting more favorable coverage, analyzing the ad campaigns, and so forth. And a tremendous amount of coverage of elections these days is coverage of the media. And it's kind of bizarre when you think about it, because you might think that the media would want to talk about the issues or the candidates' ideologies and those sort of things, but instead we're talking about the strategy of the candidates' media consultants, or we're even just talking about how the spin was after the debates and so on and so forth.
Well, and I also notice with some of the cable stations that they all have shows and they interview each other.
Yeah.
They're both the host of a show and then the guest on everyone else's show.
Absolutely, yes. You see the same personalities popping up here, there, and yon. And it is kind of bizarre when you think about it. I mean, it's so common that I don't think we notice it for the most part. But it's fascinating because you have to remember that the story of the campaign wasn't always the story of the media. Right. And as a result, we have the situation now where people really don't even differentiate between the two. They think of that's what campaigns are. And, you know, there could be, we can imagine, a very different kind of campaign coverage that wasn't all about the media and their, you know, strategies and tactics and so forth. People like this kind of thing. I think they find it interesting. I think it's sort of like, you know, insider baseball. Everybody likes to know someone's strategy. It makes us feel very smart and on top of things to know what they're trying to accomplish and so forth. But ultimately, I don't think it advances the goals of, you know, people learning what they need to know about the candidates.
Too much self-love, you think?
Exactly.
Let me see what looks like Beth from Philadelphia has to say. Beth, go ahead. You're on Radio
Hi.
Times. Hi there.
Hi. Hello. I'm here.
Yes, go ahead, Beth.
Yeah. I'll take it off speakerphone. Is that okay? Is it
working? That would be much better. Yes, go ahead.
Hold on.
All right, nothing like live radio. Okay, go ahead, Beth.
Yeah, I hate speakerphone, but I'll use it when I'm waiting. So here's my comment, and I was wondering if you could comment on it.
Sure.
I think that perhaps the advertising doesn't matter so much in and of itself, but it does matter that the ads of one party are answered by another party. So, for instance, I think it matters that the parties spent approximately the same amount of time. If one side had vastly outspent and outblitzed us with media, I think the other side would be at a disadvantage.
Well, Beth, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I'm going to toss that to Robin, the idea of the importance of answering an ad that a candidate either objects to or doesn't agree with.
There is a lot of discussion on exactly this point, and I would say to Beth, it really matters on the context in that particular campaign. If candidates are fairly evenly matched, then yes, it does matter that an attack is answered and not, and there isn't silence on the other side. However, you see, for example, if you'll remember Senator Casey's original campaign against Rick Santorum, where Rick Santorum outspent him by over $10 million on advertising because people were so unhappy with Senator Santorum's views and performance that he had to keep explaining himself. Well, Senator Casey didn't need to answer all those ads. ads, as it turned out, not at all, and it didn't make any difference in the end. Mm. We also saw that there were about $6 million was spent at the very end in this state on this presidential campaign when Governor Romney and Crossroads GPS were deciding that they thought they would say Pennsylvania was in play, and they put a lot more ads than the Democrats did, a little bit, but it was definitely lopsided. But as we've been saying, by the time that they decided to do this, the ship had sailed. And I don't think any of us who were looking at Pennsylvania's behavior historically or currently were convinced that some last-minute ads that went unanswered by the Democrats were going to make Pennsylvania be a Republican state.
But do you think that's also because they still had money to spend? Whether they spent it wisely or not?
I think that if both sides had agreed that Pennsylvania was going to be a swing state, the money would have been found and would have been redirected if that was the case. But, you know, you can go ahead and try to fake it, and that's what ultimately happened.
Diana, go ahead.
Yeah, just to add, I think it's an interesting idea to think of the ad battle as a conversation of sorts, as the caller had suggested. I think one of the problems with that, at least in terms of our ideals for political deliberation and so forth, is that the quality of that discussion that can possibly take place in a battle of 30-second ads does kind of devolve down to, you know, did not, did so, back and forth between the two claims and counterclaims. And so, you know, ultimately, if it's going to become fleshed out in voters' minds in terms of, okay, you know, there's this tendency to simplify the other side's position in a way that makes it sound worse than it really is. And when we do that in ads, you know, one thing that can happen is people can come away very, very confused about who actually advocates what, unless the rest of the news media really plays a role in filling in what they're saying in those ads and what it's about. And so I think part of the problem is, yes, it's better if it's even expenditures than when it's lopsided, but I'm not sure the quality of the conversation is ultimately what we would like it to be.
Let me get Jim from Reading to join our conversation. Jim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I am. I called on the phones to people who were voting, and also I knocked on doors during this campaign. And I was working for Obama, and I love to talk not only politics but religion, and I got a lot of questions. And the good thing was, I was able to guide the person towards a more calm approach because of the vitriol that these ads, I think $1.5 billion is spent by political action committees to steer the election. But I think we forget the public forum. We need to have a calm debate without demonizing the other person.
Here, here.
So,
Jim, I have a question. I have a question for you.
My question is for Robin Mutz. Okay, I'm sorry.
I have a question for you, and I'd like to hear from our guests as well. And did you find that people, first of all, they answered their doors and they did want to talk politics with you?
Some of them did not. Some of them did. Some of them, there was one person told me to get off his porch. You know, but I was able to talk to people, and they were interested in the conversation because I was able to guide it so that it was not an evil and a good.
I'm
talking
you.
About the facts instead of, because the facts were just thrown out the window, and most, like most political campaigns, they are.
Well, Jim, I appreciate the call, and I appreciate certainly anyone that is going door to door for any candidate that deserves a round of applause. Diana, I'm curious about your thoughts.
I would say the same thing. I think that's a very tough job, and I know my own son did some of that this year and had some very interesting experiences as a result of that. And again, I don't know what his impressions are about whether or not people had largely already made up their minds, or whether he had found some people who really were kind of up in the air or what. But as I said, this is an old form of campaigning that may still have a lot of influence left in it. We just don't know.
Robin, do facts still matter?
I would hope facts matter, but I'm interested to hear from Jim facts about what, because what I found was interesting. I had a class where a number of students intern in area campaigns in Philadelphia, is that they report when going door-to-door and calling that there wasn't so much enthusiasm about Obama in early September as there was outrage and confusion over the voter ID laws.
Oh, interesting.
And so I believe that they found, anyway, that the voters, some people who were infrequent voters, were more committed to do what they could to exercise their vote this time or make sure that they were registered because they were upset at the idea that they might have been turned away at the polls or that that was going to happen. So I thought that was an interesting backfiring effect almost. And when we know what the turnout figures are in our state and all the states with new voter ID laws, I think that we'll be studying that for a while.
Well, and we may not have the results but Diane, about 45 seconds before we have to say goodbye, but when you look at some of those long lines and you hear stories of people waiting for hours and hours to vote, something inspired people to do that.
Right. I'm always still very pleasantly surprised about how many people do care and do go to a great deal of trouble to cast ballots in this country. It really, we don't always make it easy. I did not have a difficult situation myself, but I also witnessed the long lines and so forth on television and thought to myself, you know, this is really impressive. People really care. And I agree with Robin, the voter ID thing did cause a lot of confusion at my own polling place. You know, there were signs that said, you know, voter ID laws going into effect. It was confusing, and people were asked for ID even though they weren't required to have ID. And so I think the whole thing had a lot of people confused this year.
Well, on that note, not a confusing hour, though, on Radio Times. Diana Mutz, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And she's the Samuel A. Stouffer Professor of Political Science and Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. Robin Kolodny, thank you very much as well.
My pleasure.
A pleasure as well for us. And she's an Associate Professor of Political Science at Temple University, and she studies campaign spending and political advertising. Yesterday on Radio Times, we said that Pennsylvania didn't provide paper ballot backups, but that was wrong in some precincts. Pennsylvania uses voting machines that don't provide a paper ballot backup, but many other precincts do provide a paper backup to a vote tallied by an electronic voting machine, and I apologize for our mistake. I'm Marty Moscone. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.